Please be aware that this podcast is a Star Wars free zone. I repeat, a Star Wars free zone. No discussion of Star Wars or Star Wars movies will occur during this podcast. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 76. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm looking at two Hulks. I'm comparing the two Hulk movies, the 2003 version and the 2008 version, comparing and contrasting them. Got a little feedback this time from an old friend of the podcast, and I am not talking about that movie that came out this week. I'm totally avoiding the subject because I can't have anything nice to say about it. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. You can friend me up on Facebook if you want to discuss it, because there's a lot of shit going on there. But the podcast is staying sacrosanct and is not indulging in discussions of that sort. I'm sure if you try very, very hard and you look very, very extensively, you may find a podcast out there somewhere which will discuss Star Wars movies. Great if you do, but it ain't going to be this little black duck. I've got other things to do. Now, how is everybody? It's going to be 39 degrees centigrade here, which is well over 100 old school. And it's humid. Yesterday was 41 degrees, and we went out for a 400-kilometre drive in 41 degree temperature, which was a bit of an experience and a bit of fun. And we found out one of the lovely things, and this is one of the virtues of the 21st century and the virtues of coffee culture in particular. You can go into little towns now and get decent coffee. Yes, I know the problem of coffee is a first world one, but as a friend of mine pointed out on Facebook, we live in the first world. It's okay that it's a first world problem, but the problem's been solved. It was really weird. We pulled into a little country town for what is colloquially known as a piss break and pulled over to a nice little kind of toilet block near a river. And right across the road, somebody had put up a little pop-up interstitial tiny little shed of a coffee shop, which did like focaccias and sandwiches and coffees and cold drinks and things like that. They had a couple of tables out in a dirty little front yard, roped off literally with rope, and they did a really nice cup of coffee. So quite pleased about that. Look around. If you go out driving in Australia in the countryside, you can find decent coffee now. If there's a bit of wind sound on the podcast this time around, I apologise for it, but I've got the air conditioning cranked up high due to the conditions. I really don't mind the heat that much, personally, as long as I drink lots of liquids and don't go trying to run marathons in it, which is not going to be very likely anyway. I don't mind a bit of heat. It never bothers me. I'm more affected by cold than I am by heat, as long-term listeners of the podcast would know. But, yeah, I know that people are... Our old friend Dr. Zom was complaining the other day that he had black ice and couldn't get to work. And while he was saying that, I was just in conditions not entirely unlike most of Lawrence of Arabia. But there are some things I can do with filters, so I'll try to filter out the noise as much as I possibly can. But please, in this instance, forgive me for that. So, as usual, I'm going to talk about what I've been watching. A few things. I did watch the Ian McKellen film Mr. Holmes about the end of Sherlock Holmes' life after World War II. It's not a bad little pick. It's got a nice period feel to it. It's got a mystery that's interesting to solve and explains much of Sherlock Holmes' circumstances at the time of the movies being made. Yeah, it kind of works, and McKellen is very good in it. Laura Linney's in there trying to be an English person because they don't have enough English working class actors, apparently, to fill those sort of roles. But yeah, it does work really well, and it's pretty much a three-hander for the most part, with a few exceptions and extra bits. But I did enjoy it. I did see a really weird film. A studio film from the early 1950s called Sadia, S-A-A-D-I-A. It's a Hollywood studio film which was filmed in North Africa in the 1950s. It stars Cornel Wilde, Mel Ferrer, Rita Gam, and Michel Simon, who is a French actor that aficionados of French cinema would know pretty well. Basically, it's a weird story about kind of French colonial North Africa, where there's a love triangle between a sheik, played by Cornel Wilde, a French doctor, played by Mel Ferrer, and a native woman called Sadia, played by Rita Gam. Now, it kind of blends taking medicine and science to third world countries with some kind of Arabic mysticism in a weird way. There's a witch involved and a witch's curse and things like that. It's a very unusual film, but it does have some beautiful locations. It was filmed in Academy ratio, so it's kind of a squarish aspect ratio. But it's worth checking out if you can find a copy of it. It's a really unusual little film. Didn't do any box office at all. The only reason I heard about it was I'm on a Facebook page which reproduces movie ads in newspapers from the past. And this one came up, and I thought, what the hell is this? And so I looked it up, and yeah, it's an interesting little flick. Yeah, I did the very last of my radio gigs for ABC Local Radio Darwin for the year. I am coming back next year, so they've asked me back, and that's very kind of them to do so. And rather than doing it with Liz, who is holidaying in Queensland at the moment, Mark Jeffrey and I, Mark works at ABC Local Radio in Alice Springs, decided to kind of go off the year with a bit of a Christmas movie, but a little bit of a lateral Christmas movie. And so we talked about the Bill Murray 1988 movie Scrooged, and we talked about the references in it. We expanded the discussion as well to talk a little bit about how people have go-to Christmas movies that aren't necessarily about Christmas. Things like people who like Die Hard for their Christmas movies, or there are a wide range of films that people just have as go-to Christmas movies. And we kind of talked around that a little bit. We talked about the Bill Murray thing. We talked about A Very Murray Christmas, the Bill Murray Christmas special, which I saw and was quite amused by on Netflix. And there was a little bit of fun there. We had an immediate rapport. Mark and I did get on very well on the radio. And so we Scrooged it up. We left in a bit of audio about a nipple joke in the movie, which was not my choice, by the way. It was Mark's. And I had a little bit of a time, and it was a nice kind of feel-good movie to end the year of doing the radio with, and quite enjoyed it. And as I was walking out of the ABC studios, in walked our current Labour opposition leader, Bill Shorten, with a guy accompanying him, a minder of some kind. And I walked past and looked at him, and he looked at me, and he gave me the stink eye as he walked past. Now, Bill Shorten's approval rating at the moment in the polls is somewhere around 15%, so the guy's obviously going through a lot of shit. But you don't really want to give the stink eye to voters. It's not a good look, not a good way to be. And, Bill, maybe you need to look at other job challenges for the future. Now, on that political note, what else was I watching? I did pick up on TCM. Something that I've been meaning to see, which is a kind of rare Gene Kelly movie called Invitation to the Dance, which is purely a dance film. It's a small film that Gene Kelly did with a bunch of dancers. I've only seen the first third of it too. There's a first third of it, the first bit's with as a kind of ballet dance thing about a sad clown. I haven't seen the other two parts yet, but I'm looking forward to watching them. And they should be a lot of fun to see. I love what Kelly did with it. I like the fact that he brought dance to the Hollywood screen. Even though the movie wasn't particularly a success, it is a beautiful, lush-looking bit of dance cinema. And if you're that way inclined, you should definitely see it. Staying on TCM, I decided to watch the movie that has the first... It's basically the first movie that's fully choreographed by Bob Fosse, and that's My Sister Eileen, which also stars Jack Lemmon, Janet Leigh, and Betty Garrett. And it is great because the characters are interesting. It's got a quirky little situation about two sisters who come to move to New York to find fame and fortune and end up in a living in a basement in a quite a rundown part of Greenwich Village. And Bob Fosse's in there playing one of the paramours who's wants to date and possibly marry the cute sister Eileen, played by Janet Leigh. And there are some dance sequences in this film that are fucking terrific. There's one between Bob Fosse and Tommy Rawl, which is incredibly good. And it just shows the start of that kind of Bob Fosse choreography. It's a really impressive bit of cinema for that. Let's see, what else have I watched? I watched a 1977 John Frankenheimer movie about a terrorist attack on the Super Bowl called Black Sunday, where a kind of brainwashed and mind-fucked blimp pilot, played by Bruce Dern, is convinced by a bunch of terrorists to basically turn the Goodyear blimp into a bomb and kill 80,000 people at the Super Bowl. It also stars people like Robert Shaw, who's playing an Israeli Secret Service agent, because Irish actors are always the go-to people to play Israelis, apparently. And, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Some of the special effects are a bit ropey because it was 1977. We didn't have the digital sophistication of effects that we have now. But it wasn't too bad either. Bruce Dern's really good at it. Robert Shaw less so. Marthe Keller's in it. She was the love interest in Marathon Man, you might recall, playing the female terrorist. And there are other kind of go-to guys for 1977 cinema. People like Fritz Weaver's in it and a bunch of other folk. And, yeah, it's not too bad. I picked it up really cheaply on DVD because I hadn't seen it since the 70s. And, yeah, it's kind of a nice little terrorist thriller in a sense. Now, here comes the announcement. I watched two other movies this time around, and I watched them for another podcast because The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema have asked me to give them two movies to review and to be a guest reviewer on The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. So I'm recording that tonight. I'm doing this at about 1:15 in the afternoon, but I'm recording with the guys tonight. It's going to be 5 a.m. their time. It's going to be 9 p.m. my time. And we're going to talk about the Bruce Beresford movie Money Movers, a nice crime thriller set in an armoured car company. And then we're going to talk about a movie I've already talked about on Paleo Cinema, but it was a long time ago, and I really want to see what the guys think of this one. And it's a movie called Four Desperate Men in the American version, but in the Australian and English version, it's called The Siege of Pinchgut, stars Aldo Ray, and it's set on Sydney Harbour. And I'm looking forward to reviewing those two movies with Big Willie and the Samurai tonight. So that's going to be a lot of fun for me. But that's about all I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now, and then when I get back, I'm going to compare and contrast the two Hulk movies. Hulk from 2003, starring Eric Bana and directed by Ang Lee, and the 2008 version, which is a part of the official Marvel Cinematic Universe, and that is The Incredible Hulk, starring Edward Norton and directed by Louis Leterrier. So sit back, relax, and I'll get on with the show.
What's that film that you love?
What film?
The one about the fucking hairdresser, the space hairdresser and the cowboy. The guy's, he's got a tinfoil pal in a petrol bin. His father's a robot and he's fucking fucked his sister. Lego. They're all made of fucking Lego.
Star Wars.
That's the one, right.
Okay, so let's talk about the Hulk. The Hulk's an interesting character. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created him in 1962. Stan Lee, of course, did the writing. Jack Kirby did the artwork. They just created the Fantastic Four recently, and the most popular character in the Fantastic Four was the Thing, Ben Grimm. And this is the way Lee tells it anyway. He may be retrofitting it a little bit, but it was 1962, which is a lot of birthdays ago. And the way he tells it anyway is that he wanted to create a character that basically wasn't as noble and nice as Ben Grimm, the Thing. So he took a lot of influences there. One of them, of course, being Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Robert Louis Stevenson's classic story. He took the Jewish legend of the Golem as another one. There are a whole bunch of different things that mashed up into the Hulk. Frankenstein's monster being another one. In the original comic, when it first came out, he was grey rather than green. And the reason Stanley's given for that was he wanted to have a character whose colour or whose tone didn't suggest any particular ethnic group. But the problem with that was that the colourist Stan Goldberg had problems with the grey colouring because there'd be different shades of grey in the issue. Grey's a hard one, apparently, to do in comic book printing at the time. So after seeing the first issue, Stan Lee decided to change it to green. And, of course, green became the colour of a lot of things in Marvel. Green became the colour of gamma ray sickness and things like that because, of course, the Hulk, kind of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the atomic era. Scientist Bruce Banner was testing a gamma ray bomb, and a young guy called Rick Jones ventures onto the testing range. Banner then rushes out to rescue the kid, throws him into a trench, but ends up getting an enormous blast of gamma radiation himself, which ultimately leads to him periodically and under situations of stress turning into the Hulk. Comics were very popular, and about 4 years later, when the opportunity arose, we ended up with the first television version of the Hulk being this one. Which was where I first met the Hulk, in those cartoons that Graham Waid did basically by cutting and pasting and animating Jack Kirby's artwork. But, you know, the Hulk, interesting character, he's kind of cursed by a noble act and spends the rest of his life trying to control the rage monster that's within him, as indeed Robert Downey Jr. said in the first Avengers movie. But, of course, in the more than half a century since the Hulk's creation, there have been so many different iterations and variations and additions and subtractions and retcons and all sorts of other things done to the character that it's hard to kind of nail down that this is the Hulk. There's all the other bits that came up. There's Leonard Samson turning into Doc Samson by being irradiated. There's She-Hulk. There are all these other iterations to it, but the pure line of the Hulk is probably through the visual media. So you've got the Grand Way animation as part of the Marvel Superhero series in 1966. You've then got the 1970s kind of softy, touchy-feely Hulk with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno in The Incredible Hulk on television in the 60s, which is, into the 70s, which is the one that most people were introduced to Hulk in. And it's one of the reasons why the second Hulk movie isn't as good in some ways as the first one. But I'll talk more about that when I talk about The Incredible Hulk. So it comes 1995, and they want to make a Hulk movie. Technology is getting to the stage where they can just start to do it, and the studio which had the rights, I think it might have been Universal, put it in development hell for almost a decade. There were actually the development start. I was wrong. 1990 is when it started. So basically, for 13 years, they were trying to get this film made. There were scripts written by Jonathan Hensley, John Turman, Michael Franz, Zach Penn, J.J. Abrams, Scott Alexander, Larry Kazuzuski, Michael Tolkien, and David Hayter. And eventually, Ang Lee and James Chalmers, with some influence by Michael Frantz and John Turman, ended up with the script that the film was finally going to be made as. Now, if you go to the Wikipedia page, the development gets a really long bunch of stuff. There are some really weird things that were going to be in a Hulk movie originally. There were going to be people that Banner had mutated into insect people. There were the parental abuse issue, which was very big in the comics in the 90s, was going to be involved. And, of course, it ended up being as a part of Hulk, the Ang Lee version. And, so basically it was one of those ones that were just, you know, going through Groundhog Day with new iterations of the script, new people coming on board as other people were sacked or left the project. It was just one of those ones that was sitting around, and eventually they knew it would be made in some way, but they just didn't know when. And then Ang Lee came along. Ang Lee, of course, was not known as a director of action films at all. I mean, he'd made a version of Sense and Sensibility, which doesn't really make him, in your mind, a go-to guy for this kind of a project. He'd done the Father Knows Best trilogy in Taiwan, Pushing Hands, The Wedding Banquet, and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. He'd done Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which is probably the one that brought him to the studio's attention. This was pretty much his first action film. And then, of course, he went on to do Brokeback Mountain, was a project he did after Hulk, which is kind of interesting. But, so he came on board and he wanted to do things. He brought his own composer along, Michael Danner, and there is still some of Michael Danner's music in the movie as well. There are those bits of the soundtrack, which is a good soundtrack by Danny Elfman, but there are bits of it which have got taiko and African drums and Arabic singing in them and things like that, which I think work really well in the film. But they're all Michael Danner's input there. So Ang Lee came along, and the people who did the script for him took away bits and pieces of previous scripts. The Absorbing Man was going to be in the Hulk movie, and so they kind of combined things together. And the father abuse issue merged with the Absorbing Man issue, and they made Bruce Banner's father, of course, and this is a spoiler, the Absorbing Man. And that maybe didn't work as well as they would have liked it to, but the script was more Frankenstein's monster than it was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in the sense that it was a kind of sewn together piece of previous bodies of work. So when time came for the casting, they went slightly unusual. I kind of like the casting in this one. I think it does work quite well. They were thinking of other actors. Billy Crudup turned down the role, apparently. Johnny Depp and Steve Buscemi were reported to be under consideration for the lead. Edward Norton was considered as well, but eventually they went with an Australian actor who was known for one dramatic role, and before that, for sketch comedy, and that's Eric Banner. He'd started out doing Full Frontal, a comedy show in Australia. He became very well known and liked. He did a talk show for a while. He had his own TV comedy show for a while, and then went on to play the role of a real-life character, Mark Chopper Reed, in the Australian crime film Chopper, and a straight dramatic role, and one which he did very, very well. He's a gifted mimic, and his mimicry and kind of absorption into the character of Mark Reed really made things work well. He was actually up for the lead role in Ghost Rider that eventually, of course, went to Nicolas Cage, but he chose to go with Hulk. And I kind of like Banner's Banner, if you know what I mean. It's a very different kind of reading, and it does seem at odds with what was to become the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They changed the origin story a lot. People don't do nuclear testing anymore, and turned it into a combination of his father's abuse, in the sense that he added genes to his own genome, which were inherited by his son when he had a son. The child grew up and became Bruce Kretzer because he was adopted and didn't know his original parents, and became a kind of nanotech medical researcher who was working to regenerate lost limbs for people and things like that. So he was working along, of course, with Betty Ross, played in this case by Jennifer Connelly, researching combinations of nanotech and radiation to kick into gear this regenerative process. Of course, there's a lab accident then, and the lab accident with the nanomeds and the gamma radiation combined with the genetic modifications already done to him end up creating the Hulk. So you've got Eric Banner there playing the Hulk. You've got Jennifer Connelly playing Betty Ross. Betty Ross is one of those kind of roles for women, I think, that aren't very empowering. They're just there basically to be loving and supportive in a lot of ways, and that kind of limits the ability for them to be empowered by that. They're playing kind of Esmeralda the Gypsy to the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then you've got Sam Elliott as General Thunderbolt Ross, the role which was played in the second Hulk movie by William Hurt. And I like Sam Elliott's character a lot better, even though he's a bastard, even though he's a military bastard. There's a humanity to the way that Sam Elliott plays it that works really well, and Sam Elliott's kind of charisma as an actor makes the role work. I really prefer his General Ross than I do to William Hurt's. Then you've got Josh Lucas playing Major Glenn Talbot. It's basically an asshole role, and he doesn't come out to a nice end. And then you've got Nick Nolte playing Dr. David Banner, here's what it says in Wikipedia, the mentally unstable biological father of Bruce Banner, who was also a genetics researcher and had been locked away for years for causing an explosion in the gamma reactor and accidentally killing his wife, Edith. So he's got a lot of backstory there, and he comes back into things just around the time that of the accident when Bruce Banner takes on the curse of the Hulk. And there are a lot of things in this film I like a lot. There's the action scenes in it. Well, we'll talk about a few things. The first thing is I like the action scenes a lot. I think the action scenes are superior to the ones in The Incredible Hulk. The go-to ones, a lot of people make fun of the Hulk dogs, where David Banner has basically injected dogs with samples of his son's blood and other bits and pieces and turned them into large versions of themselves. There's a poodle, there are a couple of Mastiff-type dogs who get Hulkified, and David Banner sends them after Betty Ross in order to kind of get the attention of his son. And also to kill his son's girlfriend because he's insane. And there's that great nighttime battle, which Betty sees, of the Hulk with the three Hulk dogs. And I like that. There's a primal kind of wonder and wow to that fight. Of course, you've got to remember this is 2003, so the technology for the CG isn't as smooth and flawless as it is now. And having that first battle at night time really works, particularly given that it's in a Northern California forest and you've got those large redwood trees and that kind of gnarled bark. And one of the recurring themes in the film is that kind of messy nature. There are lots of scenes where there's wood bark and lichen and rough rock textures. It's a very textured world that Ang Lee creates in this. And I think that the Hulk dog fight really does work well. It tells us what this guy's capable of and yet puts him in peril as well. And I don't care what you say, I like that bit. Then there's the probably one of, and I'll argue this point, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, one of the best battles in a Marvel film in the 21st century, and that is the prolonged battle between the Hulk and the US military in the desert. That is done incredibly well. I'm blown away rewatching that one. The Hulk running away, standing in desert ponds and on sand dunes and bouncing between rocks and just kind of flying over the desert with his arms wide, enjoying the feeling of flight as he leaps across the desert. And with that taiko drum, Arabic singing kind of soundtrack music behind it, it's a magical sequence, and I think it's showed me at least what's possible with the superhero movie as far as being a beautiful artistic piece of work. And that those scenes are really great, and even when there's an absurd moment when Hulk grabs a missile being launched at him by a helicopter, bites the head off it, and spits the warhead at the helicopter. That still works for me. That's kind of, and that, I mean, that's the sort of moment in a film. They could go both ways. It could take people out of the film and say, this is too stupid for words. Or you can roll with it and accept it as a part of that action scene. And that's how I did it. It really does work as a part of the action scene. And the contrast, of course, of the Green Hulk against the sand and ochre textures of the desert works really well. One of the problems with this film when HD and Blu-ray came out was that the way they CG'd the Hulk didn't quite come out as well as it did on the screen. Something to do with the transference gave us a much greener and kind of less subtly coloured Hulk than we would have got otherwise. But the Hulk does resemble Eric Banner quite well. And even though Banner in this one, I'm not sure it's his best acting role, but I do like him playing Bruce Banner. But the lovely thing, of course, was the Hulk does resemble him, even though they didn't texture map it at the time the way they do now with Mark Ruffalo. There's still that visible look of it being the actor rather than an entirely artificial construct. Now, the third act of the film is where it lets it down, when Nick Nolte's character, David Banner, having become the Absorbing Man, is let loose and attacks his son, and they end up fighting with the Absorbing Man as a kind of electrical elemental, and the Hulk, kind of him and the Hulk fighting and ending up in a remote location in a lake. And there are moments of that that work. I mean, when the Absorbing Man becomes a man of rock and gets absorbed into the rocks, I kind of like that bit of a constantly morphing pile of boulders attacking the Hulk. It was kind of interesting and something that worked more than the rest of those scenes did for me. And then, of course, there's the big explosion when they basically nuke them, and the Absorbing Man and the Hulk are thought to be lost. Of course, there's the little bit at the end where we find out that the Hulk and Bruce Banner have survived. But there are really a lot of really nice things about this film. I like the framing of the scenes where they have various multiple images on the screen to make it look like a comic book page. I think that while you can argue the fact that they made that choice to make it look like a comic book rather than make it look like an action film in those bits, I like the audacity and the style of Ang Lee making that choice. Whereas, of course, with the modern Marvel Cinematic Universe, what they want you to do is to not think of them as comic books in that sense, but to think of them as a standalone universe of their own. So having those visual references to comic book pages will be something that they would never do in that context. But the movie works for me. Glenn Talbot, the character played by Josh Lucas, of course, is a prick, and he gets his comeuppance in actually twice or two or three times in the movie. But and of course Jennifer Connelly and Eric Banner don't have loads of chemistry as their star-crossed lovers in this one, which kind of limits things a little bit. But I think that the ways in which it's superior to The Incredible Hulk are, first off, I love the soundtrack. I like the Michael Dana combined with Danny Elfman soundtrack that we've got. And you've heard the soundtrack, but if you haven't, you can look it up on YouTube. I'm not going to put it into the podcast. I like Ang Lee as a stylist in this one. I like the battles. I think that the battles in this one are superior to the battles in the other movie. And I really kind of, even the Hulk itself, even though it's a more primitive version because of the limitations of 2003 computer technology compared to 2008, and these things leap ahead at an enormous rate, I like the look of the Hulk more than I like the look of the 2008 version. I don't like it as much as I like the Mark Ruffalo iterations we got in the Avengers movies, of course, but I do, yeah, of the two, this is the superior one for me. Having the Hulk not be kind of slim-waisted and long-legged really works, because this is a guy who, you know, leaps miles at a time. He's got to look like somebody who's got the muscle and the bone to do that, and he very much does. There are a couple of other Grace Note moments in the movie as well. There's the bit where the jet fighter takes the Hulk up to the stratosphere to get it to let go of the jet fighter, get him to let go of the jet fighter. And I think that works really well as well. I also like that kind of visual theme that Ang Lee has in the film of desert plants and desert animals and that kind of, you know, surviving harsh environments. Aesthetic that's throughout the movie. I really do like that. Bruce Banner has a collection of lichen and bromeliads and other plants that live on the edge of things. There's a thematic line through there that I find really interesting. But, of course, the movie, it made a lot of money. It made maybe twice the budget. The budget was about in the 150s, millions, and it made about 238, 240, which isn't great by Hollywood standards, but still, they definitely got their bait back when they went fishing that time. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the 2008 version, The Incredible Hulk, with Edward Norton, William Hurt, and Liv Tyler.
I've been alone for a long time. Not because I want to be, but because until I solve this problem, I have to be.
Your target is a fugitive from the U.S. government who stole military secrets.
This is the location. Snatch and grab only, live capture.
Take him.
As far as I'm concerned, that man's whole body is property of the U.S. Army.
You have to get as far away from me as you can. Go!
There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
Target is in the overpass.
And when I lose control, it's very dangerous to be around me.
He's going in.
Pull back now.
Is that it? Is that all you got?
They want it as a weapon. And if we let it go, we will never get it back.
So if you're taking another crack at him, I want in.
I could probably arrange something like that. You ready?
Yeah. That's even the playing field.
Telling me another one of your bioforce experiments has gone haywire.
There's only one thing that can fight that. It's in me.
Okay, the 2008 version of The Incredible Hulk is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's directed by Louis Leterrier, who directed the first two Transporter movies with Jason Statham, and later went on to great success with Now You See Me in 2013, which starred, oddly enough, Mark Ruffalo, who would then become the Hulk. So it's kind of interesting that the director of the Edward Norton Hulk ended up directing Mark Ruffalo in a film of which there is a sequel now in pre-production. But to get back to the movie, it stars Edward Norton as Bruce Banner, Liv Tyler plays Betty Ross, and William Hurt plays General Thunderbolt Ross. We've also got some interesting casting in the minor players. The big bad of the piece is Emil Blonsky, the Abomination, played by Tim Roth. Now, Tim Roth isn't the kind of guy you expect to play this kind of a role. He's not a well-muscled man. He doesn't pump by him. He's not Jason Statham. He's Tim Roth. But his Blonsky, he does give him a few little interesting character beats in there, and he's got that kind of focused street thug look about him, which kind of works well. Then, of course, you've got Samuel Stearns, who later in the comics becomes the leader, played by Tim Blake Nelson, who's a cellular biologist who's trying to help Banner manage his condition. And oddly enough, you've got somebody we know better from comedic roles, Ty Burrell playing Leonard Sampson, who in the comics goes on to be Doc Sampson, a kind of superhero almost as strong as the Hulk. But he hasn't had an opportunity to do that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They've gone in different directions. They can only make so many movies in a year. But, I mean, there are virtues to this film. But I think that we'll get the elephant in the room out of the way first. The look of the Hulk really doesn't work. He's got a fairly small head, really big shoulders, slim waist, and kind of muscular but long legs. And a mop of hair. The biggest problem with that, of course, is that the Hulk, as we see him manifest, looks nothing at all like Edward Norton. He's not a bad Hulk, but he just doesn't look right, and he doesn't look like the actor playing the role, a bit like Bill Bixby didn't look a hell of a lot like Lou Ferrigno either, which brings up the other aspect to it, which is a bit limiting. Edward Norton was one of the producers on this, and he wanted this movie to take a lot of its beats from the television series of The Incredible Hulk, the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno one. And that is maybe one of the limitations. Maybe he was playing it a little bit too Bill Bixby. We do get a moment of Bill Bixby while Bruce Banner, who is hiding in Rio de Janeiro in the favelas up in the hills, is watching the courtship of Eddie's father. We get to see a moment of Bill Bixby on the screen as a kind of acknowledgement of Bill Bixby playing David Banner as he was in the television series. And I think that that's a bad move. Yep, you can like the TV series and all strength you if you do, but this is a totally different ball game, and trying to bring some of the, and I hate using this term, but it's kind of a shorthand that I'm going to use, the DNA of the TV series into the Marvel Cinematic Universe is a misstep. I don't think it belongs there, and as Ruffalo's Hulk has proved, you don't need it. You can have an interesting and nuanced character, and one of the lovely virtues that Mark Ruffalo's Hulk has and Mark Ruffalo's Banner has is that they're relatable character. He's a relatable character. He's a cursed character. He's driven. He's emotionally affected by the out of control monster he becomes. He's just the best of the best Hulks you can possibly imagine. And but this movie is something totally different. It did take two beats from the script. Remember what I said back as far as 1990 and 1995, they were making Hulk scripts. They took two things from those Hulk scripts, which were incorporated into The Incredible Hulk. The first one being when Banner finds out that he can't make love because he'll get too excited and turn into the Hulk. And the bit where he kickstarts the Hulkification process by diving out of a helicopter. Those were both in the original Jonathan Hensley script. And they were little character beats that the movie took on board and used pretty effectively. And knowing particularly the first one where the Hulk can't make love, knowing that's in there and knowing that it's canon for the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well, we then get a greater understanding of the relationship between Bruce Banner and Natasha Romanoff in the Avengers movies. The fact that, you know, their relationship is kind of very strange and very kind of unusual because of that. Now, right from the start of The Incredible Hulk, the filmmakers try to differentiate it from the Ang Lee one. The title sequences show the alternative origin of the Hulk, which is not really anything like the origin that Bruce Banner's Hulk has. Sorry, not Bruce Banner's, Eric Banner's Hulk has. So basically, right at the title sequence, they're drawing a line in the sand and saying that the Eric Banner one is not part of the series. Whereas for me, emotionally at least, I like it being part of the series. I think that they didn't really have to do that. They kind of chose to because it's marking their territory like a dog pissing on a lamppost. But I don't think it was entirely necessary. I'm comfortable with seeing Hulk and the Incredible Hulk as being, for me emotionally at least, a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I like the fact that there could be Hulk dogs out there still. But having said that, Hulk is, Bruce Banner is hiding in South America, where we see Eric Banner's Hulk end up in Central and South America. He's hiding in the favelas. He's working in a soft drink factory for no really good reason, apart from the fact that he's trying to find ways of managing his condition. He practices capoeira, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and he uses that as a meditation to try to keep his pulse rate down. The weird thing about this movie is that it's all about the pulse. It's not about emotions. The thing that seems to trigger the Edward Norton Hulk is his pulse rate rising above a certain level. So he's got a fitness monitor on his wrist that beeps and things when his heart rate goes up and when his pulse rate goes up. But unlike the Mark Ruffalo Hulk, where it's about the anger and about the adrenaline, this is merely about kind of cardiovascular stuff. And that doesn't work as well in such a nuanced way as the way Ruffalo's Banner approaches it. Of course, this is a new iteration of the character, and they've had time to think it through more than they had in 2008. But nonetheless, there are some nice things. I like the favelas of Brazil as a setting for things. I know they use them in one of the Fast and Furious movies as well. But this one kind of works. Unfortunately, Bruce Banner spills some of his blood into a soft drink bottle at the soft drink bottling plant, and he gives Stan Lee, in another Stan Lee cameo, gamma ray poisoning, and he's tracked back from that by the new Thunderbolt Ross, played by William Hurt. Now, William Hurt's going to be in Captain America Civil War playing the same character. And, yeah, fair enough that he is, but I really don't like his General Ross as a character much. I think that he's a little two-dimensional in a sense. Maybe the next movie, the Captain America Civil War, will give it a little more to kind of character to it. But in this movie, he's not as interesting a character as the Sam Elliott one from the 2003 Hulk. So the Edward Norton Bruce Banner has to travel back to the United States of America because he's secretly and encrypted in an encrypted way being corresponding with Samuel Stearns, the cellular biologist working in New York, who is trying to help him find a way to eliminate the possibility of him becoming the Hulk, or at least finding a serum or a treatment that'll enable him to function and not have to worry about it, kind of like an insulin against being the Hulk. So he hooks up again with Betty Ross, and they meet at the university where she works, and we first get our really clear and out there look at the new Hulk with his mop of hair and his kind of slim-hipped look. And there is a quite a nice battle in the university grounds, which works well, where Ross has brought in some sonic weapons mounted on army vehicles to combat the Hulk. And that bit works well. That battle is probably the best one in the movie from my point of view, where, it's the Hulk fighting the US military. And it works well. The sonic weapons thing works well. And then we brought on board with Emil Blonsky, the aging Special Forces soldier played by Tim Roth, who is given a version of the Super Soldier Serum by Thunderbolt Ross to enable him to help combat the Hulk after the failure to capture him in Brazil. Of course, Blonsky likes being stronger, likes regenerating, and takes things to a new level when eventually he encounters Samuel Stearns and finds out how far Samuel Stearns has taken the research into the Hulk and Bruce Banner. Now, the biggest problem with this movie Well, there are two from my point of view. And, yeah, you again, disagree with me. Send me an email. Send me a voicemail if you like and disagree. There are two things that I find really kind of fuck this movie up, apart from the way the Hulk looks. So we'll say three, but anyway. First one is, I don't think Edward Norton's an engaging character as the Hulk. I don't think he brings his A-game acting to it. I think he looks at it as slumming to make a buck. Even though he was one of the producers and wanted to make the movie a kind of Bill Bixby Mark II Bruce Banner, I don't think that that was a smart decision. Nostalgia for things like you liked in the childhood, in your childhood, can really mess things up as far as filmmaking is concerned. You've got to let the things you enjoyed in a child, as a child, be what they are, and if some opportunity comes along to do a new iteration of it, you've got to make it fresh, you've got to make it new, you've got to not just make it a remake of the first one. And that may well be one of the reasons why we don't have Edward Norton playing the Hulk in the Marvel Cinematic Universe anymore. Apart from the fact that, and this is purely hearsay, so allegedly he wasn't easy to work with and really didn't have the same vision for the franchise as Kevin Feige, who was a producer on the film and has produced most of the Marvel Cinematic output since then, had. He really wasn't on board with that. And a bit like Terrence Howard, they moved on to another actor for the role, and I think that Ruffalo was a great choice for it. I think Don Cheadle was a great choice for War Machine as well. That's one. Edward Norton just doesn't really grab me as Bruce Banner. You've got to remember that this is the viewpoint character of the film. This is the character we follow through everything. And to have somebody who's just not interesting in the role really kind of brings down the energy levels way below where they need to be. The second thing is the climactic battle in Harlem between Hulk and the Abomination. Now, the Abomination looks CG in his, and the Hulk looks CG in his, and it's like watching software battle. Even though Betty Ross is imperiled and he's got to do something about that as the helicopter crashes and all of that kind of stuff, there doesn't seem to be much skin in the game in this battle between the two of them. Yes, Blonsky's there and he's out of control playing the great big spike-boned Abomination, which again looks nothing like Tim Roth, which is, you know, a real alienating factor in these things. Having both the Hulk and the antagonist not look like the actors that we've followed through the course of the movie really does mean that what you're watching has about the emotional impact of a medium good computer game cinematic. It really doesn't have that incredible wonderfulness that we get in the later Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, where we have the characters established, we have actors that we invest in as the characters, and we really do feel for them and their predicament. The scene of, say, Ruffalo in the second Avengers movie, Ruffalo in the Quinjet flying off and away from things after he's unfortunately been induced to go bugfuck in South Africa. I mean, that has an emotional impact. Nothing in The Incredible Hulk has that emotional impact. And part of it is that choice to not have the protagonist look the same in both aspects of the protagonist. But again, this came out the same year as Iron Man, of course, and Iron Man was the game changer. So a lot of the ways of telling these kind of stories wasn't developed at this time, and a lot of the ways of casting and basically using the software and raising the limits raising the stakes and raising the expertise with which these stories are told wasn't really in play then. This is probably a movie from which Kevin Feige and the whole MCU Marvel Studios learnt a lot, because they made the mistakes in this film. The casting was wrong for the protagonist. They let the actor have more say maybe than he should have, which is not a bad thing if it's adding to the production. But where it's a negative thing to the production, they really don't want that, of course, as a part of the film. Not having the CG match up with the human beings. And it, for that reason, it just doesn't work as well. It made a lot of money, of course, because it's an MCU movie, and it was the way that Marvel uses social media is just so wonderfully adept that they can do no wrong in a sense. Every movie, even something as small as Ant-Man. What am I thinking of Sandman? Maybe I'm sleepy. Ant-Man. Because it's just, they kind of scaled back, and yet it still made a lot of money, and it's still a valid part of the MCU. But there are a couple of nice bits. I mean, the bit where he finds out he can't make love is kind of interesting and does have ramifications. The origin of Samuel Stearns as the leader is just a moment in the film, but it's kind of cool. Whether Marvel decide to follow through on that or not, I don't know. They may well bring the leader into one of the smaller Marvel franchises. I could see it working in one of the TV Netflix kind of franchises, or even in something like Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. There's a possibility and an opening there. And that's one of the things with these movies, that you have such a complex mosaic of stories going back more than half a century that Marvel have created in the comic book form, that you've got a real problem knowing which choices to make and which paths to follow. And there are going to be cul-de-sacs in that. The Samuel Stern story, the Leonard Samson story, all of those haven't actually paid out in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But there's a potential for them to do that, should they choose to do so. But rewatching The Incredible Hulk wasn't as fun an experience for me as rewatching Hulk, and I've seen Hulk more than I've seen The Incredible Hulk. I engage with Eric Banner's character a lot more, because maybe I've known the actor a lot longer too, because I've known Eric Banner since the 1980s as an actor. And I also like the audacity that Ang Lee brought to the production for Hulk. I like the fact that he went with the comic book motif in there. I like what he did with the story. He said it was very operatic and very Shakespearean, which it is. It's, you know, the father abuse issues and things like that could have worked possibly had there not been that third act in the film. But the visual style of Ang Lee's Hulk for me is a much more fascinating piece of work than for The Incredible Hulk. But on the other hand, none of them are as good as the moments that we've had in more recent Marvel Cinematic Universe films with Mark Ruffalo's Hulk. I'm looking forward to the fact that Hulk's going to be a major character, and of course Bruce Banner in Thor Ragnarok. I like that as an idea. I think there's more that character has to say to us in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I look forward to that too, because I think Ruffalo is such a fine actor. And apart from being a fine actor, he's an engaging character actor. He's a charismatic actor. And I think that for the role of Bruce Banner / the Hulk, the correct balance for those two things is to have an engaging and likable and relatable actor as Banner. That's one thing that Bill Bixby had. He was an engaging, fairly light actor who did some character roles, but he was an intelligent actor, and the screen and people liked him. Having that is the balance that we have for the physicality and the out of control, over the top, godlike qualities, mad god qualities, in fact, of the Hulk itself. You've got to have that balance between the two. An engaging actor for the human parts and the over-the-top craziness of the Hulk. You've got to have them both, otherwise the balance is off and the movie loses the attention. But that's about it this time around. I do have some feedback, though. We did get an old friend of the podcast send me a voicemail.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard, the voice from your past. It has been a very long time since I have called in and left a voicemail, and I apologize for that. I have been woefully behind on all of my podcasts for about a year and a half now. I've been listening to all of them, and I'm listening to each and every one of your shows. But yeah, I've just been behind, and so I always kind of felt like calling in and leaving comments were kind of silly if I'm so far behind. But just this morning, I finished the Martian Drive-In podcast. What is it? Episode number, where are we at? 75. So I'm caught up. Fantastic episode on Trilogy of Terror. And now it's time to dive in and do a Paleo Cinema Marathon. But I wanted to call in and give you an update. First off, of course, I'm not Richard from Wichita anymore. That's how I always used to call in. About a year and a half ago, my wife and I relocated and moved to Kansas City. So that happened in June of 2014. Kansas City, for those of you who may not be familiar with geography in the U.S., is about 3 hours to the northeast of Wichita. And it is a little cooler up here. We don't have the oppressively hot summers. It is a little bit hillier, a whole lot less windier. We've got more trees. It's a much prettier part of the area of the, I guess, the state of Kansas. Kansas City is right on the border of Kansas and Missouri. It's much prettier up here. And we're absolutely loving Kansas City. My wife lost her job, which was a good thing because she worked for an asshole. This gave her kind of the nudge to get out of Wichita. I work from home, so all I need is an internet connection. And the family kind of followed us up here. My son's in college about 2 hours away. Our daughter graduated from college. She lives about 20 minutes from our house, actually. She just got married. She's in a master's program. The family's doing great. The last year and a half, a lot of it has been about Jerry. For those of you who have followed me on Facebook, you know that about a year and a half ago, right after we moved to Kansas City, I mean, literally right as we moved, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, invasive ductal carcinoma stage 3. It did not look good, but my wife is a fighter. She is a true superhero. She underwent intensive chemotherapy from August to December of last year. She had a double mastectomy in January. Then that was followed up with, some bad news. We found out that the chemotherapy didn't work as well as we thought. So she went into more chemotherapy, very intensive radiation treatments. But the good news is that as of May, she was declared cancer-free. Very happy and blessed for that. And, as the summer has gone on, you know, there's been a few bumps in the road as far as the recovery. I mean, her body was filled with radiation, but she is cancer-free. She is doing incredibly well. We know that in the next 3 to 5 years, there's a lot of monitoring that has to go into place, but the doctor is very, very positive, very encouraged, and he said that things are looking great. So the fact that she's feeling great is a good sign as well. And, you know, occasionally I'll post pictures up on Facebook, and I think we usually get a lot of comments about how well she's looking. So very, very thankful for that. But that's kind of been a reason why I've been kind of running behind. I mean, we've moved twice in the last year and a half. We moved to the south part of Kansas City last year. We decided to sell our big house. We didn't need it. It's just my wife and I. So we moved to the west side of Kansas City this past June in a nice smaller townhome, which we love. We love the area. And, you know, I just got to say, as the year is coming to an end, life is pretty damn good for Richard the Monster Movie Kid and his family. So with that, I'm just going to say I'm loving the show. You're knocking it out of the park. Even though I'm not commenting, trust me, you are one of the few podcasts that I listen to and have been listening to since day one. I'm listening to each and every episode. And like I said, I'm behind on Paleo Cinema. That's next up. It's time for a Paleo Cinema Marathon to get me through the next month or so. Work is kind of slowing down a little bit during the holidays. I've got about a week and a half vacation time coming up around Christmas. So I know you don't celebrate Christmas, but I will wish a happy holiday season to you. And thank you for everything you do with both podcasts. Know that I am listening, and I am still a big fan. I've been with Martian Drive-In since day one. Paleo Cinema, I can't remember where I joined. I didn't join necessarily in episode 1, but I've been listening to Paleo for years now. And I guess I'll end with this. You know, I always used to call in when I was going down to Oklahoma to visit my mom and dad. And my mom and dad have relocated up back to the Kansas area as they were getting on in years. And it's been a bit of a rough year for my dad. He is suffering from what is called Lewy body dementia. It's actually the same disease that Robin Williams had, and which led him to the decision to commit suicide because he knew what was coming with the Lewy body dementia. It is another one of those devastating diseases. It's kind of robbed my dad of the ability to talk. He's 84. He's lived a very full life, but he's been in a facility since March. And unfortunately, that's where he'll be the rest of his life. He's sleeping a lot more, eating a lot less. I think anyone who knows and has followed any type of disease, we're kind of in the final stages of it, although that could last for months. So I'm just going to ask, because everyone, you know, has kind of heard me talk about my dad over the years. My dad was a monster movie kid, just like the rest of us. He really was. I mean, he would watch Creature Feature with me. My dad went to Star Trek conventions with me when he was, 80 years old, I think, was the last time he went. You know, my dad saw the last two Star Trek movies with me in a movie theater. We went to go see Star Trek Into Darkness when it came out in, 2013, I think. That was actually the last movie he went to in a movie theater, and it was with me. So he's a big kid just like the rest of us. And so I asked for just some prayers, thoughts, positive mojo, whatever you believe in, send my way, send my dad's way, much appreciated. And on that note, I want to wish everyone happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Hanukkah, whatever, Happy Newton Moss, whatever. Terry, I love you and love the show. Take care.
And that's back at you and Jerry as well, Rich. Just take it easy, mate. It sounds like you've got a lot of changes in your life, some positive, some not so positive. But I have been watching on Facebook and sending my support and love. You're one of the good people, and you've done a lot to keep me going in the podcast. So that's a wonderful thing. I'm glad that in some small way, the podcasts have kind of helped you through some rough areas, if indeed they have. And I'm kind of feeling ambivalent as well, because when you mentioned in that voicemail about Jerry going through chemotherapy and radiation therapy, on a podcast where I'm talking about the Hulk, who went through different kind of radiation therapy, I'm a little bit conflicted about that, but that's how these things go sometimes. Listen, have a great holiday season, mate, and you guys take care and look after yourselves and do what you need to do to make your life as good. Okay? And thank you for the feedback. I look forward to any feedback you've got on Paleo later on. But anyway, that's about it this time around, people. We're ending on that hopeful note and that kind of goodwill note. Yes, I don't celebrate Christmas. I celebrate Newtonmas, where we give gifts of knowledge and information, which isn't a bad thing, and you treat people well. Now, I think pretty much anybody can get on board with those sentiments. So take care of yourselves. If you're up north, stay warm. If you're down here, stay hydrated. It looks like Australia's going to have an incredibly hot summer this year. Last week, Adelaide was the hottest city on the planet. And Adelaide's only 800 kilometres from here to the west. So look after yourselves. Be cool. Watch good movies. If you're in the cold climate, stoke the fire. Put on some movies. Watch some good movies. If you're here, stay cool. Crank up the AC and watch some movies. And I just burped then for maybe the first time on the podcast. Maybe not. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast in the new year. Next week, in the week around the 25th, there will be another Paleo Cinema podcast. If I get a bit lateral, I may do a music podcast, or I may find movies to talk about. One way or the other, there will be definitely one out. And take care of yourselves. And as usual, thank you again to the Patreon subscribers who contribute to keep the podcast going. You go to patreon.com/paleocinema and contribute as little as $1 a month. But thank you to those people as well. So anyway, as usual, we have the credits to the podcast to acknowledge the Patreon supporters of the podcast. Take care of yourselves, guys, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy the Donut Wrangler, Tim the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor. We also have Paul who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen who has yet to have a job in the credits, and Eric of course is the set security lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.